Hello, I'm Dr. Christopher Rapuano, Chief of the Cornea Service at Wills Eye Hospital in Philadelphia. Welcome to Medscape Ophthalmology Insights, coming from the American Academy of Ophthalmology meeting in New Orleans. This is part of a series of commentaries produced in cooperation between Medscape and Wills Eye Hospital. Joining me today is Dr. Amir Azhari. Dr. Azhari is an assistant professor on the cornea service at Wills Eye. Welcome, Amir.
Thank you for having me here.
Today we'll be discussing some hot topics in cornea and external disease presented at this year's meeting. One of the more interesting, kind of newer topics that is coming in vogue is DMEC surgery. What are your thoughts on DMEC, kind of past and present, and where are we going?
It's a relatively new procedure that a lot of people are converting to. You're replacing a smaller piece of tissue, which potentially gives you better visual acuity. Not only that, you can have a better quality of vision as well, and also quicker recovery of vision, and a lot of people finding out that there's lower rate of rejection with DMEC versus DSAC. But a lot of these advantages are also seen with ultra-thin DSAC surgery as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, ultra-thin, normally when DSAC is done, you take a microkeratome or a laser and shave off about 80% of the cornea. With ultra-thin DSAC, you can either increase that amount to about 90 or 95%, or you can take a pass once and then a pass twice to get thinner tissue. So, one of the disadvantages of ultra-thin DSAC is sometimes you take off too much tissue and you perforate, and then that tissue is no good anymore.
And, the thing about ultra-thin DSAC, tissue is much easier to manipulate and potentially it's an easier procedure to do and would benefit similar to DMEC surgery.
Right. So, the advantage is you get the benefits of DMEC or many of the benefits of DMEC without the difficulty of DMEC. So what are the barriers that are kind of preventing people from doing actual DMEC surgery?
Well, the donor preparation is difficult in DMEC surgery. There's a lot of tissue manipulation, which potentially you're going to lose your endothelial cell. Also, the learning curve is very steep with DMEC surgery. You're dealing with a very thin tissue. There's a variety of techniques that have developed. There is a high rate of detachment, especially in the post-op day one, and potentially that potentially can complicate the surgery.
Right. So, that's been, a lot of doctors, including myself, the reason we haven't jumped on board to DMEC, at least not full force. In the past, surgeons have had to prepare their own tissue, which means that if you don't prepare it properly, you've actually wasted tissue. And if you don't have backup tissue, you've got to cancel the surgery. You may be on the hook for actually paying for that tissue for the iBank. In addition, the insertion of the tissue has been tricky. Lots of different techniques have been tried, whether it's a plastic inserter or whether it's just grabbing it and putting in, or a glass inserter or an IOL inserter. Lots of different techniques. And then unfolding techniques, or many different techniques for that, and then rebubbling techniques. Having said all that, a lot of surgeons have become more successful at inserting the tissue and at deciding which side is up, and then being able to unfold the tissue better. And then also there were some newer techniques of using a PI on every patient and using a full air bubble, or using a long-acting gas, such as a non-expansile concentration of SF6 gas to decrease the rebubbling rate. In addition, probably one of the biggest steps to get more surgeons into DMEC is that many iBanks now are preparing tissue, so that the surgeon's kind of not on the hook for learning to prepare the tissue or for damaging tissue, which is bad for a lot of reasons.
Some iBanks as well, they preload the tissue for the surgeon, and all they have to do is just inject it into
right. So that's kind AC. Of even the next step would be you don't have to manipulate it at all, you get it preloaded. These are all kind of new and different techniques, but I think that once we get some of these ironed out, DMEC will be a procedure for a lot of patients with corneal swelling. It's still not for all patients. Some of the speakers at the Academy mentioned that it's not good for eyes that have had vitrectomies, or at least big vitrectomies, eyes with ACIOLs, eyes with tube stents or TRABs. So there's still a place for DMEC, and there's certainly a place for penetrating keratoplasty in some patients too. Another topic that's been around, but again is being discussed more and more, is collagen cross-linking. Anything new
in that? What was interesting about collagen cross-linking, it's been used for treating corneal infections. And it's been used for treating infectious keratitis. And it's only effective for superficial corneal infections that are probably less than 250 or 300 microns. And it doesn't really work for fungal or acanthamoeba infection. That's probably because fungal or acanthamoeba infections tend to be seeded deeper into the corneal stroma.
Yeah. I mean, cross-linking is not FDA approved for anybody in the U.S., but certainly in recalcitrant infections, it's an idea that, you know, it may kill the bugs that are deeper in the cornea where our antibiotics and antifungals aren't getting to. But in several of the presentations I saw this week, it does look like it's mainly for superficial infections and for some of those and maybe not even others. For acanthamoeba, it didn't seem to be that successful in many patients. So it's an interesting adjunct, and I think that, you know, once we have it available to us more readily, we may be able to get a better idea of what infection it's good for and what it's not. Most of the time it's being used for the treatment of keratoconus to decrease progression of keratoconus. And it's mainly used in adults because that's where we start doing things. But as we know, keratoconus starts often in children. And one of the topics I noticed this week is that more and more people were presenting on their results of collagen cross-linking in children. And so the question comes up, you know, generally when we talk about collagen cross-linking, we want to see that it's progressive keratoconus so that we can use cross-linking to stop the progression. But the question that comes up is, in children, do you want to wait for it to progress, or do you say, well, it's most likely to progress in a child, let's just treat them at an earlier level of keratoconus so that they don't progress and are less likely to need a corneal transplant down the road. And I think that that's still somewhat debatable, but, you know, the longer-term results that are coming out, the 2-year, 3-year, 5-year results that are coming out in using cross-linking in children are showing that it's pretty safe and pretty effective in children. So I think there's going to be more of a trend towards using cross-linking kind of at an earlier age and not necessarily waiting to have documented progression.
There was a controversy about epithelial on versus epithelial off surgery, and most people believe taking off the epithelium, you get better results because the ribofovin penetrates better into the cornea. But the epithelial on is definitely safer than epithelial off.
Yeah, so that's a controversy that's been around since the beginning of at least cross-linking in the United States. It's been done as an epithelial off technique originally in the Dresden Protocol from 10 years ago. But when it came to the U.S. several years ago, there's a lot of people who are doing epithelium on, thinking that they have better ways and better formulations of the riboflavin that are getting actually into the stroma. The idea was that with the epithelium on, you couldn't get the riboflavin in, but with different formulations, you can get it in, and ideally then you can get the treatment down deeper. Many, if not most of the studies show that, you know, the epithelium on technique is effective, but maybe not quite as effective as epithelium off technique. However, it is much, much, much more comfortable with faster visual rehabilitation, and many fewer side effects, because most of the side effects of collagen cross-linking have to do with the epithelial defect and infections and scars and haze and things like that. So, you know, it's a risk-benefit ratio. Is a little bit less effective, you know, worth it if it's a much lower risk of complications. So I think time will tell.
Some presentations were talking about delivering a pulse technique of a higher dose of UV light and potentially allowing the cornea to oxygenate better and therefore be more effective.
Right. So it's interesting that, you know, 10-year-old technology is very different nowadays, and we're finding newer and better different ways of doing things. So it may be that epithelium on technique with some of these different formulations and different oxygenations and different UV light pulses, you know, may actually be quite as effective as epithelium off technique. Now, one of the I would think most important studies that came out, was released basically this week at the Academy of Ophthalmology, was the corneal donor study. Colonel Dorner's study the 10-year results were released. I and my partners at Will's Eye were part of this study, and it looked at using donor tissue for full-thickness corneal transplants in patients who were 40 to 80 years old, and looking at the age of the donor tissue. Was donor tissue from patients who were donating, donor patients less than 65 years old, equal to patients 66 years to 75 years? And you know, the thought before that was, well, younger tissue is by definition better. We should all be using younger donor tissue. And actually, the 5-year results showed an identical survival rate in the younger donors and in the older donors, which was very, very interesting. However, there was a little bit of a trend towards lower endothelial cell counts in the donors who were from older patients. So new funding was garnered, and the patients were followed for another 5 years, looking to see if these results were going to hold. And for the most part, the results did hold. From the donor age of 34 to 71, the results were basically identical. But interestingly, the donors from 12 years old to 33 years old had a little higher success rate, okay, higher longevity, survivability of those grafts, and the donors 72 to 75 had a little bit lower success rate. So for the vast majority of donors, success rate is the longevity in these transplants, which is full-thickness transplants, was basically the same. So I think in the very young and the very old, there may be some difference, but for the most part, they were pretty even. And then the other topic that was kind of very interesting is herpes zoster. And herpes zoster can affect the eyes.
And it's a pretty devastating disease now. It's seen more and more often in younger and younger people. And of course, it can affect the eye and it can affect the cornea. And one of the things that we see is severe loss of vision in those patients.
Right, and this can be vision loss soon after they get the shingles, or a month later, or 6 months, or years later. And in general, when one sees the rash, patients are treated with oral antiviral medications within the first 3 days, ideally, of getting the rash. That's absolutely standard treatment. What isn't known is whether taking oral antiviral pills like acyclovir or valacyclovir is helpful a month, 6 months, a year, 5 years later. Does that decrease the chance of the shingles or the shingles inflammation coming back in the eye? And Elizabeth Cohen, my former partner who was the chief of the cornea service at Wills, who's now at NYU, is in the process of organizing an NIH grant or an NIH study to look at whether using oral valacyclovir once a day decreases the chance of getting eye problems, cornea problems, inflammation problems, and also problems such as postherpetic neuralgia versus placebo. So patients will be on either valacyclovir or placebo once a day for a year, and then they'll be followed for another 6 months after that to see whether the patients who are on the valacyclovir did seem to do better than the patients on placebo. And I think that this has potential, if it's actually effective, to really change the management of shingles in the eye.
It will be very interesting to see the results of that study.
Yeah, it would be terrific. Well, Amir, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
This is Dr. Christopher Rapuano with Dr. Amir Azhari for Medscape Ophthalmology and Wills Eye Hospital.